is case number two of two oral arguments we have. We have three non-oral matters as well. I am Judge Sleater presiding. Judges Brian and Klaphockey are joining me. And our file number in this second matter, A220066, State of Minnesota, is the respondent, Brian William Freeze, appellant. And can both counsel see the clock somewhere on your screen? I see nodding of heads. Excellent. Okay, thank you. We'll proceed the normal way, though. We're by the Zoom technology today. You'll have a chance for 15 minutes each to make your comments. If for some reason we have any technological issues that we lose a connection with you, the marshal knows to stop the clock, and we'll keep it stopped until we reconnect. We do ask that you identify yourselves and who you represent for the record. This matter is being recorded, and so all other recording of this proceeding is prohibited, but you will be able to view the recording of this on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours. So with those preliminary comments, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and then begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Olson, and I represent the appellant, Brian Freeze, in this matter. This is a pretty simple matter in that we had a pre-trial omnibus issue and motion to dismiss. Mr. Freeze stipulated to a fact trial so that the Court of Appeals may review the omnibus order and have their own independent review. The standard of review for these types of matters would be de novo review to determine independently whether the trial court had, as a matter of law, found correctly. And then any, legality within the facts is determined by a clear error standard. In this case, we are asking the court to reverse the district court's order and find that there hadn't been a reasonable articulable suspicion by the officer in this case. The reason for that is
you agree, don't you, that reasonable articulable suspicion is less than probable cause and is really not a high standard. We really want to avoid an officer simply being curious or on whim or caprice stopping people. And you agree with that much?
Absolutely. We agree that it is a fairly low standard.
I look at this case and I see an officer knowing the history of domestic violence by at least the owner of the car, and having heard screaming and yelling between a man and a woman as the car is moving. That's beyond a whim or curiosity. That surely is articulable. The officer did articulate it. It seems to me to be, on the face of it, to be a reasonable expectation for an officer to check it out. So what's wrong with that?
Your Honor, I guess I would respectfully disagree. There is no determination by the officer that any domestic was occurring. The fact that there was screaming in a vehicle does not come even close to determining or defining a domestic assault within the confines of the definition of a domestic assault. And further, there was no actual articulated words that were heard by the officer, just loud noises. I mean,
that's what domestic assault is frequently about, is it not?
I would respectfully disagree. Domestic assault is very particularly defined.
It has to be physical?
It does not have to be physical, but there has to be some form of threat, an actual articulated threat. It cannot be just
yelling. But again, we're not talking about probable cause. We're talking about just enough for an officer to make the inquiry as to what's going on here, aren't we?
We are, Your Honor, but the issue we have is by saying any form of screaming between two people would automatically determine a reason to stop a vehicle would completely remove any ability for a person to have a Fourth Amendment privacy right within their vehicle. The fact that there was screaming in the car doesn't mean that they were screaming at each other. They could have been screaming at the radio.
Olson, maybe I could ask it this way. I'm interested in the differences between probable cause and reasonable suspicion, not just in terms of the standard of suspicion, but also in terms of what actually has to be articulated. Do you think that an officer has to have suspicion that each and every element of an offense is being committed in order to have reasonable suspicion? Or is it sufficient to have suspicion that one element may be present, but another one might not be?
I think the definition of reasonable articulable suspicion is criminal activity afoot. A crime is very specific. It has certain elements to it. The officer was very specific in the crime he believed may be committed based on his testimony. He didn't list several crimes. He didn't list anything. He said it was he believed it was potentially a domestic assault, but he didn't know. He didn't hear any threat being made. He didn't even hear someone scream help or anything in that sense of the word.
So let me put it this way. Do you have to observe an element of the offense in order for the activity to be afoot?
I think it certainly helps. I don't believe there's an absolute requirement. However, I think that's where State v. Britton is very important. In that's Minnesota Supreme Court case, it was clear that there had been a broken window in a car. That is an indicator that some type of criminal activity may be afoot based on the fact that under that officer's experience, that stolen vehicles can have broken windows. However, the officer didn't observe any criminal activity, didn't observe anything besides the fact that there had been a broken window. And that was not enough for the Minnesota Supreme Court. They were very clear that a broken window may mean that, but it may mean something else. And you tend to lean towards it meaning the non-criminal activity, not a criminal activity without any other factors. Here, there were no other factors that were observed by the officer himself. He heard loud shouting and yelling, but again, they weren't necessarily shouting at each other. There isn't an indication anywhere in the record that the officer saw them yelling at each other, saw any sort of threat being made, couldn't hear a threat being made, didn't even hear what they were talking about. It seems more that he was upset.
Well, he said he couldn't make out the distinct words. It sounded to him like an argument of a domestic nature. That was his testimony, wasn't it?
That was his testimony. However, his testimony of it sounded like a domestic in nature doesn't really hold fruit when you can't distinguish even what they're talking about. Loud raised voices does not mean a domestic nature. Shouting does not mean a domestic nature. That would almost imply if any man and woman were shouting, that would be considered of a domestic nature. There needs to be something more in line of how they were arguing. Even tone would make sense. Here they have nothing.
Didn't it go on for a period of time so that when it came to the first stop, officer heard it again? I mean, it wasn't just a momentary.
The officer decided that he was going to pursue this once he heard his initial. I understand that it was a longer length of time, but again, length of time does not mean anything. It truly means nothing. And the officer didn't say because of the length of time of this, therefore, I thought it was more of a domestic nature, that it could be something else. He immediately thought it was going to be of a domestic nature when he started yelling and he didn't like it. And again, it seems the bigger issue for him was more that there was swearing at him when he decided to remain and impede traffic during and the vehicle wanted to get around. Specifically, the officer started following the car. He didn't know there was any domestic, then ran the license plate afterwards, found out who the owner might be, and said, well, maybe there's domestics. Again, the issue we run into here is just because someone has a domestic on their record does not mean criminal activity afoot. And it is a whim to assume that an owner of a vehicle having a domestic must mean a domestic if there's heard shouting. That isn't based on training and experience, and it's not even based on the officer's training and experience. And I would note the district court themselves did not find that the criminal history really is what turned or determined that there was reasonable articulable suspicion. The focus seemed more on the shouting as well as the shouting at the officer himself. Those seem to be the two things that the district court had its main focus on. And again, I think the issue we run into here is we are using screaming and coupling it and assuming shouting or assuming a domestic nature when there's nothing implied there. The officer had no reason to assume anything was going on. He literally could not articulate fully what of that shouting made it of a domestic nature, which would be a domestic assault. I think what's interesting here is he didn't find it to be a disorderly conduct. He didn't find it to be outrageous. That could have been something he thought, but he didn't. He didn't find it that way. And the court must look at what the officer believed the criminal activity was, not what on an independent glance could be any criminal activity. Because again, it is what the officer believes and articulates here, and not what the district court could find independently based on those facts. It is important that this court also review it in the similar fashion. This officer was very clear what he claimed to be the reason for his stop, which is he heard shouting of a domestic nature, but he couldn't provide any reason or evidence of what made it so, or what made it could be a domestic assault by statute. Again, I'm not saying that there couldn't maybe have been other reasons, but if you don't articulate those reasons, I think it's clear then you don't have a reasonable articulable suspicion, because you couldn't make that fashion. You could not determine that. I think going back to it, we've had no specific citations from my review of the our Minnesota case law that explains why criminal history, getting back to that point, would be considered a reasonable articulable suspicion along with shouting. But by itself, there are several cases within the federal appellate courts that have cited that that isn't a reason. And I think the point of that is it doesn't provide enough evidence. The fact that you have been convicted of something does not mean you are going to do it again and again. I think, again, that gets us into the point of now you're using character evidence, which we wouldn't allow in a court.
Ms. Olson, could I ask you, I understand the cross-examination where, and you've highlighted that about his decision-making, but if we look at the articulation of the facts by the officer, and I'm trying to, and from an objective analysis, what would be improper legally of the three things that he referenced before stopping the vehicle, meaning the, of course, the yelling. And it seems to me at least relevant to that, that the appellant then yells at the officer in a marked squad car at the same time. And then there's a check that indeed he has law enforcement contacts related to domestic issues. It just seems to me those three combined, as Judge Klopacki pointed out, take it out of mere whim or curiosity, it would seem reasonable at that point. Those dots are pretty closely connected to a potential crime afoot to do the initial stop. Is there anything that would be legally inappropriate of those three things? And I understand your point about what he perhaps articulated in cross-examination, but the judge referenced all three of those too in the judge's order.
Your Honor, I think that viewing them together is not necessarily appropriate in this decision-making because they detail different events that aren't coupled together, meaning there's...
But don't we look at the totality of the circumstances?
You look at the totality of the circumstances, that is correct, Your Honor, but you look at it on whether or not with those circumstances altogether, that would show that crime being afoot, or that it was articulated that that crime could be occurring and therefore creates a stop. That's why you have to separate them somewhat. The first incident is screaming and yelling. Fine, that occurs. Then the second incident is him yelling at the officer. That has nothing to do with him screaming and yelling, or them screaming and yelling, because again,
it shows that he's pretty angry though, doesn't it?
I don't think it does. And to imply that or infer that would be an inappropriate decision on the part of a court. Again, you can't infer tone, you weren't there. And I think the officer didn't articulate that the screaming and the swearing would therefore mean he must be angry or he must be committing a domestic assault, which is the only reason why he got stopped. It wasn't a disorderly conduct. It wasn't something else that may have coupled it. It was a very specific type of crime. And
well, isn't an assault include the possibility of someone doing an act with intent to cause fear in another? And And the screaming and hollering and shouting could be that act?
It could, but not screaming at an officer who was not being assaulted.
No, I'm talking about the screaming now between the occupants of the vehicle.
I think the problem here, Your Honor, is what the officer said and his reasoning were three things, and they were coupled together, and that is what the district court made a determination on, and you can't couple them together. They're three very different acts, and they are not part of the same incident. They don't follow one after the other. The fact that you're yelling at someone, and again, both of them were yelling at each other, then there was him yelling at an officer for impeding traffic. Maybe not the best thing to do, but it's not criminal in nature to scream at an officer. In fact, the law does not say that you can't. You have a First Amendment right to say whatever you want. And he didn't make a particular threat. He didn't say, I'm going to kill you. He didn't say, if you don't move, I'm going to beat you up. He said nothing of that. He told him to get out of the way. I mean, he swore, but other than that, that's just more offensive. And Your Honors, I see I'm out of time. May I finish my statement?
You may.
Thank you. It may be offensive language, but it's not assaultive or threatening language under the statute. They are separate items. And then the third thing, the fact that he had domestics on his record does not entail he's going to have a domestic with this person. That is more of a preemptive situation where he's trying to now cobble together something to make a stop, which is improper. And that is why we're requesting it be reversed. Thank you.
Can I just ask one more question?
Yes, you may, Judge Klopfagy.
It wasn't just having a domestic on the record, was it? I thought that the officer knew that your client had, quote, a long history of domestic and disturbances.
He did a license check and he found that there had been a history of domestic convictions, Your Honor. However, that does not equate, having convictions does not equate that a criminal action is occurring at
It was more than one domestic conviction, was it?
I believe I can't remember. I know it was more than one, but I can't remember the exact number. Again, okay. I think the issue though is you can't equate convictions with criminal activity happening at that time.
Very well, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal and counsel for respondent. You may identify yourself and then begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court. My name is Kimberly Woodgate, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. With all due respect, I do believe that opposing counsel, their assertion that we need to separate these three distinct events or reasons that the officer articulated to make this stop is not accurate. The court here does, in fact, need to look at the totality of the circumstances in order to have a full understanding of what the officer's reasoning was. Opposing counsel made the comment that the court cannot infer tone because the court was not there. However, that's exactly why we give the weight to the officer's impressions and experience and articulation that the court does, because we are not there. We have to rely on what they see and what they know and what they observe. So in putting all of those three things together, one, hearing the yelling, taking it piece by piece, the officer hears two people yelling at each other. That signals, based on his many years of experience, that, okay, something may not be exactly right here. Let me just listen and pay attention. And I will note, he did not stop the vehicle immediately at that time. He just paused and listened. Then he heard the appellant yell at him and swear, and he noted, okay, that's not normal, but it does add to the level of something's not right here. There, somebody at least in this car is angry, maybe not necessarily at me, maybe at each other. Again, he did not pull the vehicle over at that time. He actually went through the stop, pulled over to the side, and continued to observe the situation and listen. He then continued to hear the yelling, decided at that point to follow the vehicle. But again, this was not an immediate stop. He's just continuing to observe. As they're driving through town, they come to another stop. And again, he hears the two yelling at each other loud enough so that he can hear them, you know, down the street in the car behind them. So at this point, again, it adds to it. It's just another level of okay, something's not right here. And based on his experience, his first thought was potentially domestic. Now, there's two levels of that. There's
Ms. Woodgate, before you get into that, I do want to ask you his testimony on cross-examination and how that plays into our review, because he did say that he had made his decision to stop before the two second parts of the last two portions. And so how do we review that? How should the district court have reviewed it? The district court really didn't hit that head on. And does it mean that hearing yelling in a vehicle behind a squad car is sufficient for an officer to go and, or should we disregard that? Or did the district court impliedly find it not credible that that was not the only reason, even though the officer said it was the only reason by that cross-examination?
I think you're going to two parts to that. One, he said he had made that decision at that time based on the circumstances. But if circumstances had changed, he could have then changed his mind. If he followed them or they continued to pass through and it was two people in a car, everything was fine. He didn't hear anything. You know, he could have changed his mind at that point. I don't think that we can take that to fully say that anytime people are yelling, that it's a cause for concern. You know, take, for example, people watching a football game. You know, even if you have people in on opposing sides cheering, there's a lot of yelling, but you do have to take into account tone. And this officer is very experienced and can tell the difference in tone. Versus, you know, in an argument versus just two people yelling or even, you know, two friends walking down the street, getting a little excited about something. There's definitely a tone to that.
Does it matter? Are we supposed to take a subjective view of this or an objective view?
Your Honor, based on the standard of review, which I believe opposing counsel maybe slightly misstated. We're not asking the court to look at whether or not the lower court was clearly erroneous. This is a de novo objective review of whether or not there was sufficient basis for.
I didn't mean to throw you off by saying review or view. Don't we look at what a reasonable officer would have done with the knowledge, collective knowledge of all officers at the time of the stop, not at the time of the subjective decision to make a stop, but at the time of the stop, aren't we asking would an objective officer, a reasonable officer, have a basis to suspect criminal activity is afoot?
That's correct. At the time of the stop. Yes.
So it doesn't matter so much what this particular officer suspected, because we're taking an objective view, not a subjective view, right?
Right. So we look at not only, I think in this case, you can take it one step further and say, what would a reasonable person do? And we give extra weight to the police officers because they have more knowledge than the general public, more experience. You know, they're trained to look for certain things. But in this type of situation, we can even expand that to a lower standard and say, what would a reasonable person do? And, you know, we get 911 calls all the time of somebody hearing, okay, there's arguing next door. And to opposing counsel's point that there has to be a direct threat, I don't believe that's accurate. You can hear muffled yelling coming through the walls next to you such that it could cause concern, even if you don't know exactly what's being said. You could hear, you know, screaming, crashing, things being thrown. There's any number of things that could lead someone to believe that there is an emergency situation. And back to my previous point on that, when we have the officer articulating that this particular case might be a domestic, again, there's two parts to that. There's one, potentially somebody who is engaged in criminal activity. And then two, potentially somebody who needs help. And I would note that the officer did not know which party would be which at this time. So it was purely a low level intrusion. And I think that's what the court needs to look at too, is what was the level of intrusion? Opposing counsel's statement is that because there was not a domestic, or because in this case, we did not charge appellant with a domestic, that then the stop wasn't reasonable. I don't think that's accurate. You know, we want to say, thank goodness there wasn't a physical domestic assault occurring. But going back to what was the reason for the stop, was that by itself reasonable? And I think that, you know, as a matter of public policy, we do want officers to be able to investigate these types of situations so that it doesn't get out of control, that it, you know, so if they're seeing
something. If I can follow up on my last question, what role does the subjective knowledge of this officer about domestic violence history, what role does that play in our de novo review of whether there was reasonable suspicion at the time of the stop?
Just to clarify, are you asking domestic violence history specific to this appellant or his knowledge?
Correct. Wasn't that in the record that the officer had some personal knowledge of his history and then relied on that as well as his observations of muffled yelling?
Yes. I don't know that the specific history of this appellant's domestic violence record played a majority role in it, to say. I think
I'm not talking about why he stopped. I'm saying, what role does his knowledge, his personal knowledge, have when we're asking what would a reasonable officer, or as you put it, a reasonable person, suspect?
It does play into it. It goes to the totality of the circumstances. I don't know that we can give it a specific weight or percentage, but, you know, good to the law school example, if we're trying to build a brick wall, it is a brick in the wall, you know, and it depends on the history and the amount of knowledge that a person or the officer would have in order to say how much weight it has. I would like to note, though, that it was not just the domestic nature, but the appellant's history of combative behavior towards law enforcement in the past. This particular officer had not actually had an experience with this appellant, but he had only known from, you know, reviewing other officers' reports, which again goes to the collective knowledge of the officers in general. And that was his reason for calling for backup to assist, was a safety concern, given that he knew of the history of it, whether domestic or just combative in nature.
I clarify on that last point, Ms. Woodgate, does the record show that's when he called for backup after he checked the record?
Yes, when he recognized the name then.
Okay, thank you.
Right, I want to, for the last few minutes, and maybe focus on the emergency aid exception. I think that's a point that appellant has overlooked in this part of it. And again, it's not specifically, or does not have to only be looking at criminal activity in this type of case. The court has held that an officer may enter a dwelling without a warrant if they reasonably believe that a person inside needs emergency aid. And I would put to the court that that's a significantly higher standard than just stopping a vehicle. And when we look at the level of intrusion here, again, if the officer had stopped appellant's vehicle and it turned out they were not having a serious argument, it was just, you know, getting heated over politics, whatever it may be, nothing serious, then nothing would have happened from it. It would have been, okay, have a good night, be on your way, and that would have been the end of it. But looking at the totality of the circumstances before that, everything put together, all of the bricks in the wall, led the officer to believe enough that there's a potential threatening situation here that he at least had his duty to investigate in that. I would note that the cases that appellant cites, Britton and Terry and the others specifically, they do discuss a lot of this idea of when we can stop a vehicle. But the main difference in this case is that there was no threat of immediate physical harm to anyone in those other cases. And in our case, that adds a very significant level to the officer's reasoning and justification for his actions. You know, officers are not only to catch criminals, but they are also out in the community to render aid and assistance. So I do want the court to take note of that part of it. Your Honor, I guess with that, if there's no other questions at this time, we would just ask that this court affirm the lower court's decision that based on the totality of circumstances, the officer's stop of this vehicle was reasonable and justified. Thank you.
Very well. I see no other questions. Thank you, counsel. Now, counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. Just getting into the emergency aid exception, I would note the district court never brought it up. It is not an argument that really should be before this court, and it is put in there to try to make a claim that this officer had an emergency aid exception. That was never addressed. The officer didn't have an emergency aid exception. He never cited that he felt it was an emergency aid, and that was the reason for the stop. The reason for the stop is he believed there was criminal activity of a domestic assault afoot, which is why he wanted to stop. I think going into the point of looking at the reasonable articulable suspicion of all officers, it is correct to use that somewhat objective standard, but you use it based on when the officer determined he was going to make the stop. He decided he was going to make the stop when he heard shouting, not when he had done the criminal check and not when he—
Is there some authority in your brief that we look to the— not at the time of the stop, but at some previous point in time?
Your Honor, I think it goes towards what a reasonable articulable suspicion is, which is the officer indicates what he believed the reasonable suspicion was. And when he determined he was going to make a stop, the fact that he waited to make said stop doesn't mean that that was the decision. The decision—
Right. I'm just asking, is there some authority in your brief for looking at not the time of the stop and not asking, was there reasonable suspicion at the time of the stop of the Fourth Amendment intrusion, but instead at the time that this subjective officer decided to make that intrusion? Is there some authority in your brief or that you're aware of, if it's not in your brief, that points us to the relevant time period is not the actual intrusion itself, but some period before that?
I do not believe that that has ever been fully analyzed, Your Honor, under Minnesota case law, and I haven't seen any under different case law. I think it is under the interpretation, though, of Terry and Britton and those other situations, where in Britton, the fact that we had a non-criminal activity of a broken window, it was based on what the officer said and the totality of the circumstances of, well, I saw this, so therefore I believe this was what was occurring. What he saw and the reason he was going to make a stop was he heard shouting, and that was when he knew he was going to do it. That's what triggered in his mind, and that is where we are asking the court to look. The further stuff, that would almost give the impression that police, once they determined they were going to make a stop, well, to make it more credible, let's impede traffic to get this person upset. Let's do certain things. And I understand that that's not how we view it. And that's why we shouldn't view it that way. We should view it at the time that the officer was going to make the stop and just decide that's what I'm going to do. And then use that objective standard of, would a normal police officer hearing shouting coming from a vehicle say, yeah, that is a domestic nature. Going towards what the—
Before you move on, I guess let's assume we accept this rule that you're stating and that we articulate it apparently for the first time in this opinion. What would happen then if you're trying to apply that rule in the future and an officer decides at point A, time one, right? T1 decides, I think I have reasonable suspicion. I'm going to pull the car over, but I'm going to wait. And while that waiting is happening, while they're following a car, let's say, the officer observes something else. Is that additional observation relevant to the determination of reasonable suspicion under this rule that you're asking us to apply?
I think it could be if he said that was another reason why I wanted the stop. In this case, he didn't say that. He never said, well, because of his criminal history, I now felt I must stop. What he said was the fact that he had that criminal history made him want backup, but that wasn't why he all of a sudden decided, I'm going
to
stop.
But you're just saying we would have to go back to the subjective decision-making of that particular officer. And if that was something that this that officer added to the list, then it could be considered. But if it wasn't something added to the list, we wouldn't consider it either. We're bound by that subjective decision that the officer makes and why.
I think it's a twofold prong of you are bound by the reasonings the officer gave and said, this is the reason why I decided to stop. And then you look at it from the objective totality of those circumstances. If he says to the court, Your Honors, I saw this happen, so I wanted to stop. I started following him and I saw this, which made me go, oh, I do need to stop him for that reason as well. Then objectively, would an officer with that same knowledge and those same understandings determine that that would be an appropriate stop? I still think you would. Oh, I apologize. I see my time is up. May I finish my
sentence? You may finish yet.
Thank you. I think you can still use the objective standard fairly easy. You're using the subjective statements of the officers, but you're using them in an objective way. So you're looking at his reasonings, but I don't think it would be fair to say, well, I'm going to use these three things because that's what he said, but that's not really why he said he stopped him. He told us very clearly in this case why he stopped him and why he was going to stop him. And then these other events occurred, but he didn't say, well, that just solidified my reasoning or that. That didn't happen in this case. I think you could, though, in other circumstances. Yes.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing.